properties, and I will talk also at the end about the causal Green's functions. Basically, I will talk about such Green's functions based on only one example, but hopefully things will be clear what this is about. So again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. It's very possible that the material I will be presenting is already known to you, but still it is of very high importance in theoretical physics, because you will encounter the integrals that you're going to see many times. So yeah, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. Okay, Fourier transform. So suppose we have some point denoted by x belonging to the d-dimensional real coordinate space. So this is the d-dimensional. Real coordinate space. Basically, x is the set of real numbers from minus infinity to infinity in d dimensions. And we have an integrable function u of x. So u of x is an integrable function. Then we can define another function, u of k, that can be symbolically written as some operator f acting on u, given by the following integral. The integral over the whole space of u of x e I scalar product k times x dx. So this uk is called the Fourier transform of the original function. And since u of k and u of x are connected to each other, then we can write down the inverse Fourier transform in the following form. U of x equal to f minus 1 acting on u of k. This is how it is written. And it is equal to the integral over rd u of k e in power minus I k x, k dot x, d k divided by 2 pi over d. Note 2 pi in power d in denominator. So when we have the inverse Fourier transform, we typically add 2 pi in power d. That's pretty much it. Any questions? So talking about functions u of x, we consider the integrable functions. So integrable, by the word integrable, we mean the functions that that decay fast enough at infinity so that we could consider the integral, say, better to say, over the whole space of u of x dx. And this must be smaller than infinity. So we are dealing here with the functions that decay fast enough. So let's consider an important example. Let's compute the Fourier transform of the following function, e in power minus x vector squared divided by 2. So it is clear that e in power x squared divided by 2 equal to the exponent. Here we have minus 1 half and the sum over squares of all components of this vector x. I equal from 1 to d times xi squared. So if we substitute this function into this formula, then we will see that f of e in power minus x vector squared divided by 2 equal to the product I from 1 to d of some integrals I that will be the functions of ki. So basically, k dot x is the sum from 1 to d of ki xi. So what is I of ki? So if we look at this formula, we are going to have that this is the integral from minus infinity to infinity dxi times e in power minus xi squared divided by 2 plus I ki xi. So this is just the one-dimensional Gaussian integral. So you probably saw the Gaussian integrals in the course on quantum mechanics, right? Right. So it is known that the simplest Gaussian integral from minus infinity to infinity dx in power e minus, so dx e in power minus a x squared over 2 is equal to the square root of pi over a. And a more complicated Gaussian integral from minus infinity to infinity dx e in power minus a x squared. Actually, no, this is just without 2, sorry. Sorry, minus e in power minus a x squared is equal to square root of pi over a. And this integral of e in power minus a x squared plus bx is equal to e in power b squared divided by 4a times square root of pi over a. So this is just a reminder. So if we substitute a equal to 1 half and b equal to I ki, then we are going to have that this integral will be equal to e in power minus ki squared over 2 times 2 pi. Right? So since our initial integral is the product of such integral for different ki, we are going to have f e in power minus x squared over 2 equal to 2 pi times d over 2 times e in power minus vector k squared divided by 2. It is essential that the Fourier transform of the function e in power minus x squared divided by 2 is proportional to the exponent that contains minus k squared divided by 2. Hence, it is quite straightforward to write down the expression for the inverse Fourier transform. Say if we, I also get to put this, right, f minus 1 of e in power minus k squared divided by 2 times 2 pi d over 2, then this will be exactly e in power minus x squared divided by 2. Okay, any questions here? So this is the original transformation, and this is the inverse Fourier transform. Okay, let's now talk about the basic properties of Fourier transforms. So basic properties. Fourier transform. I will talk about the properties that are quite easy to prove. One should just employ the definition written above, but still it's a good idea to reiterate all those properties explicitly. So the first property is linearity. Basically, if we have two functions and take the sum of these two functions, then the Fourier transform of the sum will be equal to the sum of Fourier transforms. So the second property is called translation. So if for any x naught v of x equal to u of x minus x naught, then the Fourier transform v of k equal to e in power I k x naught, k dot x naught, u of k. So to prove this, one has to plug this v of x into the above formula and make the shift of variable y, take another variable y equal to x minus x naught. Okay, good. Property number 3, called modulation. So if for any k naught v of x equal to e I k naught dot x times u of x, then v of k equal to u of k plus k naught. So the proof also follows from the definition written on the board above. Property number 4, scaling. That is also quite simple property. So if A, say, is some number not equal to 0, then the Fourier transform of the function u of a times x equal to 1 over absolute value of a in power d times the Fourier transform taken at k divided by a. So this is just the property that can be proven by simple rescaling of the variable. So you just simply substitute a x by y and follow the definition. So any questions at that point? These properties are quite simple. Quite simple, and it can be proven very, very straightforwardly. Okay. Now, property number five. Property number five is slightly more interesting. Derivatives. So let's, D is the derivative taken with respect to the ith component of vector x. Then we can ask a question. What is the Fourier transform? Fourier transform of the following function, f, di, then dj, and so forth, dl, u of x. We basically differentiate the function u numerous times by taking the derivatives along different directions. So what is the Fourier transform of this function? So it is possible to show that it will be given by minus iki times minus ikj and so forth times minus ikl times u of k. Well, the proof is quite simple. Suppose we have just only one derivative. We take the formula given above, substitute the function containing derivative, and integrate by parts. If we have many derivatives, then we integrate by parts many times. And each integration by parts will give us this prefactor. Yes, you can easily do this as an exercise. So similarly, we can show that f of the function ixi times u of x equal to the derivative of u of k along direction ki. Well, to prove this, we do the following. We will write the following way. Ixi u of x equal to the integral over the space of real variables, ixi u of k, right? E in power minus ik dot x d k over 2 pi d. And what we do here, we rewrite ixi times this exponent as the derivative. First, u of k times the derivative minus d over d ki e in power minus a k dot x dk over 2 pi d. So, and subsequently, integrate by parts in the k space. So this will be equal to the integral d u of k over dki e in power minus I k dot x dk over 2 pi in power d. So this proves that the Fourier transform of this construction is equal to the derivative of u with respect to ki. So the generalization to more complicated cases where we have the product, say, of ixi, then ixj, and so forth, is quite straightforward. We simply this time differentiate the function u of k the necessary number of times with respect to ki. Any questions? If there are no questions, I will mention two more properties that you are going to prove during tomorrow's tutorial. Not today's tutorial, but tomorrow's, because today's tutorial will be devoted to Green's functions. So the first property is called the convolution property. So property 6, convolution property. So suppose we have the following function. W of x, and it is denoted in the following way. Curly, so left bracket, u star v, and all this construction, a function of x. What does this mean? This means the integral over space of real variables, u x minus y times v of y dy. This is called convolution of two functions. So the theorem states that the Fourier transform u of w of k equal to the product of u of k and v of k. This is what you are going to prove during the tutorial. And finally, the last property I would like to mention is called Parseval's equality. So it states that for two functions, u of x and v and v star of x, those functions can be generally complex. Now, nothing prohibits us from using the complex functions in the definition of Fourier transforms. So for two functions, u of x and v star of x, we have the integral over the whole space, x space, of u of x times v star of x dx equal to the integral over the whole k space, u of k times v star of k dk divided by 2 pi over d. Very, very good. So this is the equality you're going to prove during tomorrow's tutorial. Any questions? So if there are no questions, I will mention also quite briefly about one more very important thing, namely Fourier representation over delta function. So you saw the definition of a delta function in the previous course, right? Dan talked a little bit about this, right? So if we have some function u of x and write down its Fourier representation, integral over k space u of k e in power minus k dot x dk over 2 pi times over 2 pi in power d. And if we take this definition and substitute instead of u of k the inverse, the definition of inverse Fourier transform, then we're going to have integral over k space. And here we substitute integral over real coordinate space u of I e in power I k dot y dy e in power minus a k dot x dk divided to pi in power d. So obviously what we need to do, we need to recover original u of x. Here we have u of y, here we have u of x. So this just means that we must have u of y times delta function of the argument x minus y integral over dy, integration over the real coordinate space related to y variables. This is what we have to have in order to recover the original u of x. So from this expression, we deduce that delta function has the following representation. So from this, it follows that delta x minus y, delta of x minus y equal to the integral over k space dk over 2 pi in power d, e in power I k dot x minus y. So this is how the delta function can be expressed via Fourier integral. So we can also write that the integral over x space from e in power I k dot x dx is equal to pi in power d times delta function of x. This formula is used very often in field theories. Any questions? Okay, no questions. I see that this material is quite familiar, quite simple, but nevertheless. So let me mention that Fourier transform is only one example of possible other Fourier transforms. And I will mention, just briefly mention two more, not Fourier transforms, but integral transforms. So I'm going to mention just two more integral transforms that you may encounter in the future. Thank you. note other relevant transforms. One transform is called Laplace transform. So if we have some function u of x, for u of x, we can define the following function that is a function of some variable p. And Laplace transforms is typically denoted by letter L. L of u equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of u of x times e in power minus px dx. And the inverse transformation reads u of x equal to L minus 1 of u equal to the following interesting integral, 1 over 2 pi times the integral. I will explain what it means. From gamma minus infinity to gamma plus I infinity, u of p e in power p x dp. So this integral between gamma minus infinity to gamma plus I infinity is called the integral with respect to the Bromwich contour. This means that if we take the complex plane and take some gamma on the real axis, then we draw the contour that passes this gamma and goes from minus I infinity to plus I infinity. So the contour, this gamma, is arbitrary, but should be chosen in such a way that all poles of u of p are to the left of this vertical line. So those are just the poles of u of p. So this integral in practice is calculated by closing the contour to the left so that it encounters all poles of u of p. There are numerous tables of Laplace transforms of different functions, and you can look at the tables and look how the inverse Laplace transforms are calculated using the Bromwich contour. So this is called Bromwich contour. I'm simply mentioning about this because you won't be using Laplace transforms apparently in any of your courses. It's just an example of the other relevant integral transform. And just one more example of an integral transform is the so-called Mellin transform that is even more exotic than Laplace transform. Mellin transform. So if we have some function u of x, then we can define the following transform, u of sigma equal to, and it is denoted as m of u equal to the integral from 0 to infinity u of x times x in power sigma minus 1 dx. So, and the inverse transform is also expressed as an integral over the Bromwich contour and given by m minus 1 of u equal to 1 over 2 pi I gamma minus I infinity gamma plus I infinity u of sigma times x in power minus sigma d sigma. So this integral also uses the Bromwich contour. So this integral transform is quite exotic, and I don't know where it is used. Apparently, it is used for solving some kind of integral equations, but we're not going to use it. I'm just mentioning it. Any questions about it? Yeah.
So I know you said that we aren't going to be using these much, so maybe it's not that relevant, but I'm just curious. The Fourier transform has a physical interpretation of the frequency spectrum.
Yeah.
Of some waveform. Do these other guys have any kind of simple interpretation like that?
Well, I'm not aware of.
Okay.
I'm not aware. It's not interpreted, say, as a mode expansion. Mm-hmm. Or just spectral expansion? No. Apparently, it is just a tool for solving some classes of equations. For example, Laplace transform is used in solving the so-called Wiener-Hopf equations. These are equations that are defined on the half space, not in the full space. So, because Fourier transform is very useful when you have the problems that are defined in the whole space, differential equations, integral equations. And Laplace transforms is often used when you have the problems for fields defined on half space.
And that's why it's zero.
Yeah, that's what it is from zero to infinity. But application of those methods is much less straightforward and quite cumbersome, I would say. But concerning Mellin transforms, I said these transformations are even more exotic. So there is one class of integral equations with the kernel, with some special kernels, where you can apply Mellin transforms and solve them. But they are very exotic. Yeah.
I've got a little comment on that.
Oh, really?
To be very useful in order to compute some special amplitudes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, yeah.
Mellin transformation like this puts strong restrictions on u at times if it has to dial, you know, it has to dial u.
Yes. Exactly, as you can ascertain from the definition. Yeah. So, very good. Now, I will consider a very important example where you can use the Fourier transform and determine the Green's function. So Fourier transforms are very useful when you have differential operators with constant coefficients. That's why I decided to spend so much time talking about the Fourier transforms. So I will consider forced, damped harmonic oscillator and causal Green's function. So suppose we have the equation that describes the motion of a damped harmonic oscillator subject to external force. The differential equation is as follows: x double dot plus 2 gamma x dot plus omega squared plus gamma squared x equal to some function f that will be the function of t. So dot means the derivative with respect to time. So gamma is supposed to be small, but nevertheless, it has the physical interpretation of friction, of the force that slows down the motion of harmonic oscillator. So gamma is the proper frequency of the oscillator, and it is convenient to write this equation in such a way that we add gamma squared to omega squared. So the question is how to determine the displacement. What is x of t? So apparently, this equation can be written in the following form. The differential operator acting on variable t, actually it acts on s, but the differential operator contains t. Lt acting on x equal to f of t, where Lt is equal to d squared over dt squared plus 2 gamma d over dt plus omega squared plus gamma squared. This is the second order linear differential operator, and you see that the coefficients before the derivatives are just constants. And this allows us to use the Fourier transform method to determine the Green's function. So for this type of differential operator, we use the Fourier transform method to determine the Green's function. So if Green's function is defined as the solution of the equation L acting on G equal to delta of T, then we can write that x of t is equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity g of t minus tau f of tau d tau. This is completely analogous to what we had during the previous lecture. So the question is how to solve this equation and determine the Green's function. We're going to substitute the Fourier transformed variables. So we write g of t equal to minus infinity, integral from minus infinity to infinity, g of omega e minus I omega t d omega divided by 2 pi, and use the Fourier representation of the delta function standing in the right-hand side. Delta of t equal to the integral between minus infinity to plus infinity e in power minus I omega t d omega divided by 2 pi. So we substitute these definitions into this equation. So the derivative with respect to time I converted into powers of I omega. And we have minus omega squared, minus because we have I squared, minus 2i gamma omega plus large omega squared plus gamma squared g of small omega equal to 1. So from this, we can easily write down the Fourier transformed Green's function. It is equal to 1. And here we will write what stands here in the square brackets in the following way. Omega squared minus small omega plus I omega and all this squared. Right. So we have small omega squared with the minus sign, then 2i gamma omega with the minus sign, this large omega squared with the plus sign, and gamma squared will also come with the plus sign. So this simple form is the benefit of the fact that we added gamma squared to large omega squared. And we can write this in the following form. 1 divided by 2 large omega, and here the sum of two fractions. The first one is 1 over large omega minus small omega minus I gamma plus 1 over large omega plus small omega plus I gamma. Right? So if we sum the denominators, then sum these two fractions, then in the numerator we will get 2 omega that cancels with this 2 omega. Why did we write this solution in such a form? Because we can see where the poles are, where the poles of the Green's functions are. So the poles of g of omega are omega 1 equal to large omega minus I gamma, and omega 2 equal to minus large omega minus I gamma. If we draw the complex plane omega, then we will see that both poles lie in the lower plane. Minus large omega, here large omega. And gamma. So the planes are here. So sorry, the poles are just here. Okay, then we substitute this expression into the formula for inverse Fourier transform and get g of t equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity, g of omega, e in minus I omega t, d omega divided by 2 pi. So, and what do we need to do? We need to calculate this integral using the residue theorem. So for that, we need to close the contour of integration. And here comes a very interesting fact. When t is smaller than 0, then we must, t is smaller than 0, then we must close the contour of integration in the upper half plane. And the upper half plane does not contain any poles. What does this mean? Yeah, we get 0. So we get 0 if t is smaller than 0. And we're going to get something non-zero if t is greater than zero. Let's see what we're going to get if t is greater than zero. If t is greater than zero, then we must close the contour in the lower half plane, like this, and take into account the residues from these two poles. So let me go to the other board. And write down the value of the integral that one obtains when t is greater than zero. So g of t will be minus 2 pi times I, right? Here we have 1 over 2 omega. If we look at this expression, times minus e in power minus I large omega times t, e in power minus gamma t, plus e I large omega t, e in power minus gamma t, and also 1 over 2 pi. This 2 pi comes from here. This cancels. The signs are very important. This minus because we close the contour in the lower half plane. And this minus comes when we take the residue in this first half fraction. So as a result, we get e in power minus gamma times t divided by 2 I omega times e I large omega t minus e minus I large omega t. And what's this? We see that we have the sign of omega t, and we write e in power minus gamma t divided by omega times sine omega t. So we write here that when t is greater than zero, then we have e in power minus gamma t divided by omega times sine omega t when t is greater than zero. A very interesting result that allows us to write that allows us to write the Green's function in the following way. G of t equal to theta function of t times e in minus in power minus gamma t divided by omega sine omega t. The Green's function that contains theta of t is called causal. Hence, this Green's function is a causal Green's function. It is zero when t is smaller than zero. So the displacement will be thus x of t. The integral from minus infinity, if we assume that the force started to act at t equal to minus infinity, from minus infinity to t, e in power minus gamma t minus tau divided by omega times sine omega t minus tau f of tau d tau. Can anyone tell what the physical meaning of this expression when we substituted the causal Green's function into the formula for displacement? Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. So the causal Green's function indicates the fact that we are considering a response to something external, in this case, external force. And a response cannot come earlier than the cause. Than the cause of this response. So that's why the Green's function is called causal Green's function.
And in the bottom integral, that's, of course, just by making
the top limit. We're considering the displacement at times t, and integral contains everything, every moment of time that is smaller than t. So, in fact, in physics that involves differential equations, partial differential equations containing time, we're interested almost only, I would say, in causal Green's functions. We will see later for example, such a thing as retarded potential is also related to causal Green's functions for the wave equation. Meaning that first we have the motion of charges, then we have the field. This is the physical origin of radiation. But we will consider this later. Okay, any questions related to those things? That's pretty much all I wanted to tell you. So, and I have 10, 15 minutes to start the new topic. Okay, we're now moving to the topic when we will be considering Green's functions that are related to partial differential equations. Green's functions for partial differential equations. So many differential equations, they involve both space and time. For example, heat equation, diffusion equation, then wave equation, Laplace equation, Poisson equations, the latter two I used when we consider, for example, electric potential. The notions of Green's functions and self-adjoint operators are pretty much similar to the case when we have the differential operators involving only one variable. Here, when we talk about partial differential equations, we consider the differential operators quite often of the following form. A times d squared phi over So sorry, I will skip cos phi. D squared over dx squared plus 2b d squared over dx dy plus c d squared over dy squared plus, say, for example, d over dx plus e times d over dy. These are the derivatives of lower orders plus, say, f. So the functions, the parameters, better to say a, b, c, d, e, and f, they can be themselves functions of x and y. This is the differential operator in the space of just two variables, x and y. But you can have instead of y, for example, time t. Yeah, t here is the variable that should be considered on the equal footing with the space variables. So what is interesting here for us is the part that involves the second derivatives. If we consider the so-called determinant a times c minus b squared and look at the sign of this determinant, then we can distinguish between the so-called parabolic differential operators, hyperbolic differential operators, and elliptic differential operators. So if d is smaller than zero, then the differential operator is hyperbolic. If d is equal to zero, then the differential operator is parabolic. And if d is greater than zero, then it is elliptic. So this definition is apparently taken from the geometrical algebra. Because if we look at the equation, I believe ax squared plus by squared. Apparently, or cy squared equal to. No, anyway, I don't really remember how it is exactly formulated. So, but this is the definition of hyperbolic, parabolic, and elliptic differential operators. So let me write down the examples of equations we're going to consider that are related to hyperbolic, parabolic, and elliptic cases. The representative examples. First, heat or diffusion equation. D squared, I will write down for simplicity the equations in one dimension, and all equations will involve time variables. D2 phi over dx squared minus kappa d phi over dt equal to f of x comma t. Heat or diffusion equation is the representative equation of parabolic type. It's better to write down a little bit below. Poisson or Laplace if the right hand side is equal to zero, if f of x y equal to zero equation. So d phi over x over dx squared plus d squared phi over dy squared equal to f of x y. This is the example of elliptic type. This equation does not involve time at and it contains only the derivatives with respect to special variables. If the right-hand side is equal to zero, then it is called Laplace equation, and you see that this is the equation in two dimensions. If the right-hand side is not equal to zero, then this equation is called Poisson equation. And both of those equations are of elliptic type. And finally, the third representative example is the wave equation. Wave equation. D squared phi over dx squared minus 1 over c squared d2 phi over dt squared equal to f of xt. This is the equation of hyperbolic type. Any questions? That's pretty much it, what people consider when they talk about linear partial differential equations. Of course, there are many more differential equations, but many of them are nonlinear. For example, the so-called Korteweg-de-Vries equation. Yeah. The Schrödinger equation, it's a linear differential equation, yeah. So at a time-independent Schrödinger equation is the equation of elliptic type because it contains the Laplace operator. The time-independent Schrödinger equation, you're talking about this. Time-dependent, well, it is also the equation of elliptic type because it has the first derivative over time. So when we talk about the classification according to above mentioned rules, we are looking only at the terms that contain the second derivative. Of course, one can find some equations apparently that describe the oscillations of membranes that contain the fourth derivative. But these are quite exotic. But such equations exist, yeah. So if the equation contains the derivatives higher than the second order, then I don't know what the classification is, to be honest. Okay, any other questions? So those equations are solved given the so-called boundary conditions. If we have the linear differential operator of one variable, then the conditions are specified on the ends of the segment. Here we consider some domains that are higher dimensional, that have the dimensionality greater than one. And those domains are called omega, and the boundary is called the omega, and it has some normal. So one specifies the boundary conditions. At the omega. And the boundary conditions fall into three major categories. So So boundary conditions are quite often labeled as BCs. Types of BCs. A. Dirichlet BCs, boundary conditions. So meaning that phi is specified on d omega. B. Neumann BCs. The normal derivative of phi in the direction perpendicular to the boundary is specified on d omega. It is written this way. D phi over dn, or in other words, n dot, the gradient of phi is specified on d omega. And the third class of boundary conditions is the so-called Cauchy BCs. So for Cauchy boundary conditions, both phi and the normal derivative are specified on the boundary. Both phi and d phi over dn are specified. One should keep in mind that this domain can include time as well. So if we have phi a function of t and x, then typically, especially when we consider the wave equation, we specify the condition, the initial conditions and the conditions on the boundary of the spatial subdomain. Wave equation quite often requires Cauchy boundary conditions to have a complete solution because it contains two second order derivatives with respect to space and time. So in general, when we talk about these boundary conditions, this area omega includes both spatial variables plus time. Okay, any questions? Because it's time for us to stop. Tomorrow I will continue with the subject of calculating Green's functions and for these particular equations. Any questions at this point? It depends on the equation.
Right.
It depends on the equation. So Cauchy boundary conditions are typically required for wave equations, but are ill-posed or simply incorrect, for example, for heat equations. So for heat equations, Cauchy boundary conditions are irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So here,
yeah.
So but the boundary, we have only time domain, right? And we assume that the system evolves from minus infinite time to plus infinite time. So we can just assume that at infinity, the force is equal to zero for the integral to converge. So basically the force starts at minus infinity and slowly rises somehow.
Yeah, but you didn't impose that condition when you solved the equation.
I didn't impose because we are on the infinite segment. T varies from minus infinity to infinity. So we can here only assume that the system, the oscillator, is at rest at infinitely distant moment of time. This is the effective boundary condition. How to explain this to you? So here when we have, strictly speaking, when we consider the Green's function of only one variable, we specify the conditions on the ends of the segment. So this segment can be finite, say, from a given moment of time to another given moment of time, and it can be infinite. So here it is assumed, so if you look, if you substitute t minus 2 infinity, right, then you get that the displacement is 0. And apparently the same is true for the first derivative with respect to time. So our force should satisfy the condition that it is absent when t equal to minus infinity. And concerning the moment t equal to infinity, then of course the displacement is determined by the solution of the equation. No, this solution effectively implies some boundary conditions, that the displacement and velocity of the oscillator are equal to 0 at minus infinity. No, there are the boundary conditions. Look, if you put t equal to minus infinity, then you get 0. Okay. Any other questions? Then okay. Today we're going to have the tutorial devoted to the calculation of Green's functions for the one-dimensional operators.